I want to sit in my mom's lap right now.
It's what makes us different.
I went on every single door until someone told me yes.
Well, I'd have to have at least one book.
Every human has like a similar core.
Get out there and meet as many people as I can.
You're listening to Being in Chronicles.
So far, I have interviewed a baker who loves to dance, a public speaker in the making, an immigrants' rights advocate, a human rights activist, and an artist, all millennials, and all came to the US either around or after 9/11. Their experiences as immigrants were unique but very similar in many ways. But today, I am changing things up a bit. My guest for today's show came to the US in the 90s. His journey from a fighter pilot to a branding executive who has worked for internationally renowned brands like Prada and Giorgio Armani is an interesting one, to say the least. He's also a director who wants to create documentaries that highlight social issues. On a personal level, he continues to explore and practice Sufism's diverse cultural legacies in an attempt to achieve inner peace. Ali Arkhan will talk to us about different facets of his life, from being a fashion guru to a filmmaker and a Sufi. I'm your host, Sadia Khan, and you're listening to The Alien Chronicles, which starts right now. Welcome, Ali. So happy to have you on my show.
Thank you, Sadia, for having me, and greetings to your listeners.
So you grew up in Karachi, Pakistan, a city of, at the time, 8 million individuals. And now I think it's, what, 13 million? And then you moved to US, and this was in the 90s. And you moved to Waverly, Iowa, which was at the time, what, 8,000 people living in that small city. It must have been a hell of a transition. What was going through your mind when you came to Waverly, Iowa? What were your first impressions? And what were initial few months like?
Whoa, let me tell you, it was a long flight. like most people of my generation at that time, I didn't plan to come to America or any European country. I was in Pakistan Air Force, and it was an amazing career, and I just thought this is something where I'm going to go with, and this is where I'm going to hang my hat. And, excuse me. And then I got suspended from flying. I couldn't fly anymore. So that was like ending a box. So I wanted to go and find a place where I can be myself and discover myself, really, because I was 20 years old and I was looking for a change, rather geographical change. So at that time, a lot of American universities used to come to Pakistan at that time and recruit students, and you get an I-20, an admission letter from them, and next thing you know, you just come to school here. So at that time, there was a seminar done by this private liberal arts college in Iowa, and then I just happened to be there. And considering I didn't have any planning or any aspirations to come to America, so it was an amazing, amazing seminar. Got to understand what they were offering, and I applied, and and I got the visa, and I came to study in Waverly, Iowa, at Wartburg College, which is very interesting because I never even heard of the name Iowa in my life before. So I'm like, okay, it must be that the place chose me. So that was my story. So I don't have any real stories about coming to school here, and I never planned it. It just happened, and the place chose me instead of me choosing the place. So that was an amazing, amazing part. And through that, the most important part of my earlier settling in this country came along because the school had this program of having a local host family, and I was very, very lucky to find the Iversons, who adopted me as one of their sons. And after 28 years in this country, they're still they are my second family, or my family, my mom away home, away from home. So it's been an amazing experience exploring second set of family or life in America through them. So initial years, initial months were very crucial. Coming from 8 million people to 8,000 was a huge transition. Mm. Something I was scared, nervous, but optimistic. So my American family really helped me navigate those challenging waters. I got to see an American culture through an American family, which I never thought of it like a hyphenated family, like an American family or Pakistani family. I just saw the same value system which I grew up with, the love, unconditional love and care and same unity of the family. And it was just an incredible time. So it was really helpful to have somebody like this holding hands and walking you through the culture. And through that, it cemented my relationship with this country.
So what impressed you the most about American culture? And what did you miss the most about Pakistani culture when you were living in Waverly, Iowa?
Well, definitely food. Iowa was, and I don't think so still is, by any means, comes closer to gastronomical capital of the world. So the choices were very limited. But by that, I meant my family, my friends, and I was very homesick. I was very homesick for a very long time. I was very sheltered. I had a very sheltered childhood growing up. So coming in here and living in this environment, it was a growth opportunity. But at the same time was, I knew that it's an opportunity of a lifetime to learn something about myself, which growing up in Southeast Asia, like, you know, it's something, it's always, she don't want to talk about anything. It was quite challenging to know what communication means. So I love the culture where you can be yourself and people can communicate openly and talk about anything. I don't know, maybe it wasn't in my family, but we talked about everything, but we talked about nothing.
That's true. I mean, that's how Pakistani culture is. We don't talk about much. So when you were in Iowa, now you don't see as much diversity as you would, for instance, see in New York. So were you stereotyped in any way? Like, did you have any incident where, you know, somebody said something?
Actually, it is a school town, so you do see some diversity around it. So it was, people are a little bit more used to of seeing people around. But, you know, when you first arrive here, you don't have those filters. I didn't have those filters. And I'm telling you, when I arrived here, it was such an amazing experience. And I was such in a happy land. I was absorbing everything. And everywhere you go, like, I would say there was an element of curiosity. In a way, people want to know about you, who you are, where you're from, and how are you thinking. Yes, of course, there were some stereotypes. Somebody will say, like, oh, do you have video games back in Pakistan? I just thought that was so funny. I'm like, no, actually, there used to be one in next town. So we used to take our camel. We take about an hour and a half, 2 hours, and you go there, and then, you know, you sit all together, and then you play one game, which goes into 50 people. And I swear, honest to God, they used to just think it's so true. They will look at you with, like, you know, like, wow. And I said, just kidding. So it will get a little bit lighter of situations.
How long were you in Waverly, Iowa?
I went for a semester and a half. And I realized it, as great as it was, and it was a good founding space for me. I was finding my grounds, but I realized it. I wanted to be in a place where it's a bit more opportunities for me, because place I was coming for, I didn't have a safety net to go back home. And I knew that if staying in Waverly, Iowa, it might work out and might not work out. So I wanted to go somewhere a little bit more diverse, a little bit more cultural, a little bit a place where I can see some growth in myself. So I decided to come to the Big Apple, to New York City.
And how was the transition like?
It was just like coming from a fast treadmill to a fast treadmill. So it was really easy. Like, you know, coming to New York, like, people always thought, like, you know, what did you think? And I always thought, like, I literally found no difference coming from Karachi to New York. It was just the same, minus the skyscrapers. We didn't have tall buildings, so it was really nice. Other than that, like, in the same rhythm of people and same voices. And I just thought it was incredible. I was home.
So what is the difference between New York of 90s and New York today? And I mean, in terms of how people treat each other or other things, do you find any differences when you look back when you first came here versus now?
Very important question, especially today. So when I first arrived, like, I didn't see no difference. I just thought, maybe I was a little naive, but if there was any, if somebody was, all I felt was there was an element of curiosity where people genuinely wanted to know you. So it was fine. And coming to New York City was like coming to Manhattan, was literally truly the melting pot of its time. So, you know, you see everybody from every part of the world. So there was never a question where you came from and what did you do before this, who your family is, like, you know, all of those questions didn't, because I think we were all working towards the same goal of betterment of ourselves, our environments, our communities, and eventually the places which we represent. So I didn't feel any negative stereotypes or any change of value systems, but all of it changed on 9/11. September 11th came in, and I think nobody has been same since then. We all are healing through that experience. I remember coming in, I was here that day, and I witnessed that day very clearly, and I just happened to be near World Trade Center because I needed to do some paperwork. And on the way back, I saw from the back of my cab, and I can see and I'm hearing what's happening, and it was, you were numb by the process, but I had to get to work, so I had to accommodate all the employees who were at work environments to make sure they get accommodated and they get situated. On the way back, I was walking on Fifth Avenue and literally tears rolling down my eyes, and there was no traffic. Everybody was just walking, and it was at the same time when you're mourning a part of you, because I felt still to this day that I lost a lot because I embraced the city as my home. But the next day, a very weird thing happened, and I started to feel like I'm not, a part of me felt like that I'm not allowed to mourn. Mm-hmm. And my pain and my suffering is not as great as theirs. And that duality kind of shook my ground. And from that point, it was a constant affirmation to yourself, no, you got to move on. Every time you see hundreds and hundreds of those posters anywhere of loved ones being missing or just in the environment when you feel all of that pain and anguish and anxiety, you stay in solidarity with the New York. So as sad as it is, this happened, but I am glad I was with my fellow New Yorkers, where there was no division, where one day we were all one.
But Ali, do you think you felt guilt as well because of the religion that you come from? And I ask this question because I came around that time, and I, even to this day, when something goes wrong in the U.S., if there is an attack or something goes wrong, I feel guilty, which I shouldn't. Those individuals who perpetrate those acts of violence do not represent me or my religion. But do you, and if so, what ways do you try to mitigate it, or what gives you comfort?
Well, to be honest about it, I can relate to that. Like, every time there's a bombing or this sort of any of that incident happened, my first heart goes out, God, I hope there's not somebody from Pakistan. Mm. And it's the truth, and or it's not a person of color or something like, not that it reduced the calamity, it's just the natural reaction. I don't know where it stems from, but I know what helps me solve that, because instead of staying in this state of anxiety and not knowing what to do, I created a system around myself to support organizations and people who are making changes and who are working towards it. So that was a real comfort for me, to finding a community and relate to it and work through it. So it kind of constantly affirm your own action, and then you work towards it. You're 100% right. I am only your mirror. So I'm only going to see myself in you. So if I'm going to work around something like that, I choose to surround myself with the people who are making a difference in our environment, mm-hmm. who are going towards a change, and who are who recognize that these are alienated incidents in any community, in any environment, regardless of their culture, their religion, or their color.
So going back to your initial years, so you came to New York, you went to NYU.
Correct.
And you did your bachelor's in what?
International Marketing and Research.
Okay. And you were a fighter pilot back home. And then you transitioned into the fashion world. How did you end up there?
Well, as I said earlier, it's a long flight. you know, coming from Southeast Asia, and especially from Pakistan, creativity was never really encouraged.
That's true.
My father was a painter. He was an artist, Renaissance man. But I don't remember him ever telling us, like, okay, it's okay to listen to certain type of music or listen to this or, you know, have artistic sensibility or his sense of poetry at that time, like Fez and Mita Kimir, like, you know, it wasn't like, you know, I'm talking about, I'm 15 years old, like, you know, it was not in me at least. So coming in here to America, I think it was a very interesting time because the transition was happening. So I got to learn a lot of new things, you know, in terms of music, in terms of art and eventually into fashion, which happened really accidentally because I had a time off in between. And a friend of mine, she was working in one of these fashion stores, and she's like, why don't you come and do our paperwork? And I'm like, okay, sure, no problem. I think that sounds fun. Literally because I was rather looking forward for a really comfortable summer. So I start working for them. And from there, I got recruited to work for Saks Fifth Avenue. And I'm like, okay, that sounds interesting. And I didn't know anything about fashion, literally. And I showed up and working at Saks Fifth Avenue, I got to understand the basic elements of fashion, the science behind fashion. And that really piqued my interest in it. I'm like, wow, this is amazing. But then I wanted to go to grad school. And at the same time, Prada came and they recruited me for once. And for this, when they came in second time, I'm like, okay, if I think it will be a good chance, like, go work for Prada, and then I can go to grad school at the same time. So that was, I'm like, okay, in 2 years I'll be done. My family was already very unhappy with me. They're like, okay, anybody coming from that part of the world in 90s and going into fashion instead of finance was not really something, was my parents were not really excited about it. Anyway, so I came to work for Prada for 2 years in my mind, and I was their stylist. So I just thought it would be great. And next thing I know, I was with the brand for 8 years. And
wow,
it was an amazing experience. I got to learn so much about fashion through a brand, which is a true trifecta of style, art, and design. So it wasn't necessarily about the color which is in or the length of your skirt. I think it was an ideology, and that really sat well with me. And I still to this day, like, you know, it is a house which carries a really strong place in my heart.
And after Prada, you joined another fashion house, right?
Well, I knew that I wanted to stay in the industry for some time. So I started my own consulting company, and I worked for different fashion houses. I worked for Hermes. I worked for a lot of European houses. And eventually, coincidence of fate, my old president was working for Armani, and they asked me to come and join in, and it was the regime change, and it was a fantastic opportunity to work for them, and I worked for them for 4 years, which was an incredible, incredible opportunity to work for a heritage house. And so it's until that time I was still in a very fashion world.
Getting ready in the morning, normally I don't pay attention to what I'm wearing, and today I was like, you know, I have to meet Ali, so I have to look nice, or at least wear things that are not like fashion mishaps or blunders. How are your culture and your tradition reflected in your work? Because you worked here for almost 28 years now. What are some of the positives that you take from your culture and tradition and you know, incorporate that in your work ethic?
Wow. It was a great opportunity because I realized that certain places where I was working, I was the only person of color. And I didn't even realize it when I first started. But then I just thought with that, it came a sense of responsibility. And it was about always giving you 200%. I mean, it was not open for discussion. It was always 200%, no right to complain, just carry on. Quite earlier part in my career, like, you know, in my early 20s, it was very, I heard it a few times, and if you don't like it, you can go back to your country. And I'm sure every immigrant, or not every immigrant, but most of the people get to hear some form of that. And with that, it creates it stirs something in you, and that's the alien. So you can choose at that time to whether you're going to join in or you're going to separate. And I always choose to join in and unite people. So, like, to me, my work was more important, and I always felt very privileged to work in these fashion houses and the environments where I work in and the positions I carry to make difference in whatever capacity I could. And I, in a way, I never thought that I'm representing my culture. I just thought I was representing myself, and my culture is who I am.
You know, it's for me at times, and this is something that happens to me, I just can't separate the two. And I think it's just the burden of who we are, and being representative of our culture or religion is something that I somehow take to heart. And I don't know, you said you don't, which is a different perspective, but an interesting one indeed. So looking back, if I were to ask you, being a person of color and an immigrant, did it hurt your career or did it help?
I don't know. Let's put it this way. It definitely was interesting to have a unique voice in the room. You look different. And people were always interested to hear ideas. And I didn't think so it mattered which accent it came from. I didn't think it mattered which color you came from. So to me, it was, or I was just like one of those Energizer bunnies. It didn't really matter to me. Or as my old CEO used to call me, like, here comes Ali and his Let Me Take You to the Moon projects. Uh-huh. So it really didn't matter to me. Like, you know, I just went in because it was so important for me to get things done and see things differently or make a change or make a difference or try something different all the time that it really didn't matter what other people thought of it. Like, all it mattered was, like, you know, how do I make them see and what are their challenges? And, like, you know, it was more business and more about assimilation of the thought process than who is saying this, where it's coming from. So it wasn't really important at that time.
Okay. So what are some of the interesting behind-the-scenes stories in different fashion shows or, yeah?
Wow. No kiss and tell, you know that. it's not easy. You know, it was a very privileged environment. I must say that, like, you know, to work with A-list celebrities all the time to the last moment to go to the Vanity Fair party or dress them for the Oscars. It was one amazing experience after another. Quite chaotic when you're in your jeans and t-shirt and they are into their super couture gown. It's just an amazing experience. But that being said, towards the last of my projects, which I did with Armani, was to design a made-to-measure suit for Peter Dinklage from Game of Thrones. And to be honest about it, it was so funny. We had an amazing time. And I got to tell him, like, I'm like, well, I have never seen Game of Thrones.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow.
And it was just like, and I think it was a relief for him.
Really? That
because I didn't think so. And we talked about other things and life in general, and we talked about the shoot and things, and we connected through that. And I never, because I literally didn't have any interest, I never saw, because more and more your friends tell you about binge watch a show 4 years ago, then you were like, I'll get to it when I get to it. And I'm like, I don't want to talk about it. When you miss the moment, you know, you miss the moment. You don't want to be like, you know, carry on. So anyway, for me, it was just like, you know, fast forward, after watching Game of Thrones, binge watched it for like weeks, I was just like, oh my God, what a fun thing I could have that. So I could have told you like a fun story, but it wasn't really as fun story because it wasn't really, I don't know. We had an amazing, interesting time. And, like, you know, we did the shoot for Esquire and where he was the cover of it and wearing the suit, which I designed for him. So it was really an amazing time.
Oh my God, that's an amazing story. So you've, like, obviously you interact with fashion designers. You've seen so many models. You live in fashion world. What are some of the best and worst purchases you made?
There are no worst purchases, darling. But I must say that I got an ostrich coat with a mink lining from Prada. It was an off-white color.
That's I have only to see like that.
It is an incredible... You will. So that is definitely like my fantasy purchase, and I'm really, really proud of it. Every time I wear it, you always get photographed, and it's just... It's such an... I don't know. It's just a kind of false moment, but at the same time, you kind of enjoy that. It comes with a fashion perk. My worst purchase was, although I will never admit to that again, I bought a fake Rolex one time. Oh my God, it was just, and my friend John was with me, and then still this day, I get reminded of that, so.
Yeah, that's one thing that, like, so for me, the mantra is, if you can't afford it, just don't buy it. But I can understand. Like,
I get it.
I have attempted to do it a few times.
I get it. It was a green face. It was a hunter green face. It was fantastic Rolex, which I didn't want to buy because I don't really like Rolexes. Sorry. But it was a weak moment. I was going on holidays to some place, and I just thought, okay, that's fine. Even if something happens to it, that's quite all right. It's not my real watch.
That's true.
It was my Folex, like my fake Rolex.
So we have fashion guru here with us. So what is the biggest fashion blunder or mishap every girl should avoid?
Well, today we are living in fashion renaissance, to be honest, but there are no no's. So you can do anything with the confidence and it's a go. But that being said, when it comes to women and fashion faux pas or mishaps, I just think over-accessorizing.
Yeah.
To me, I always think, like, you know, when you think you have too much on, just always look in the mirror and take something off. Trust me, you will thank me later. Just take one thing off, and it always helps. And other than that, maybe undergarments, just reflection of some of it, or just seeing some of it in its own entirety. It just kind of like, it doesn't matter how great your outfit is, if I see some of the strap or something showing on, or some sort of unnecessary lining. I think that's really, I find it super tacky.
So Ali, you're still in fashion world, but now you're also working on a documentary to create awareness about different social issues. Again, that's another transition that you did. Why did you transition into filmmaking now?
Working in fashion industry for almost 20 years as a storyteller, I wanted to find another medium of expression. I wanted to add my voice and observation to all the architects of change. And I just thought there was an internal change, which I recognized at the time. I loved my industry and I wanted to continue to love it, but I wanted to have new tools. I wanted to grow from it. And at the same time, as I saw there was a climate of change outside, so, and I wanted to document and add my voice to this observation, working with the architects of change. So I left my career in fashion, I put it on hold, and I was exploring new venues to find another medium of expression. So out of my bucket list, I've always wanted to make one film in my life. So I'm like, okay, this will be a good time. So I went to School of Visual Arts, where I always had a very good relationship with, and it was an amazing, amazing experience. And they were starting a documentary filmmaking course in 4 days, so it was great. I got to speak to the chair, and then boom, I was in. And I am so eternally grateful for them for easing the process on me, because I was just like a grandfather in the class. Everybody came in with their 8, 10, 20 film resumes, and here I was, never carried a camera. On a video side, I was a photographer, but I never made videos. So it was amazing to get into that. I was also very involved at that time within the holistic community, and it helped me dive deeper into the spiritual ecology and environmental and social reforms. So that led me to my current project, which was, it's about 4-year long-term observation working into this coastal community that helped me understand and document the project as I was learning and exploring subjects like permaculture, urban development and sustainability, and community building. Mm. So these are the subjects I was always very curious about, but living in Manhattan, and I just thought, like, you know, it was always a silo, so I was always interacting with my own types or certain group of people, but I wasn't, at some point, I wasn't really growing. So it was an amazing experience to go into this community. And the minute I arrived there, it was, I felt a sense of communal relationship, a little human aspect of it. And more I scratched the surface of this community got so much more fragrant to me. And as I was learning these new processes, I kept documenting them and kept documenting them. And it became this 4-year project of hope.
So when are you releasing this documentary? When can the listeners see, watch it?
Well, hopefully next year. It's a first-time documentary filmmaker, so it's just like having your first child. You're never ready. But it, you know what? I want to keep it as authentic as possible. So we are growing with this project. We have a very good relationship with some distributions. So I'm very privileged that, and I find it very lucky that, like, you know, I have a rein on it that I'll see when the project finishes. But hopefully, like, next year, like, because I really want to start other projects, so it will be interesting to finish this project and bring it into light.
On a personal level, you believe in Sufism, and that is an important part of who you are as an individual. And first of all, I would like you to explain to our listeners what Sufism is and how has it changed your personality over time and things that you do in terms of social change that you're trying to bring. Does it have anything to do with what you believe in?
Again, I think it has a lot to do with my upbringing. Growing up in Pakistan, and I always thought like Sufism was always about Qawwalis and listening to Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan and, like, you know, that Sama aspect of it, which I had a quite much of a quota of this. We all grew up with listening to that beautiful music and going to, if ever you can make it to one of the shrines, and you'd see some aspect of it. But there was a very diluted version of any type of Sufism or any type of ism. To me, I couldn't relate to that, really. I just thought there would be something more to it, mm-hmm. which came back to my life much later into it. So to me, like, you know, Sufism is the mystical aspect of Islam and introspective journey that brings one closer to the divine. The reason, one of the few things which helped me get closer to that was the teachings of Hukukul Ibad and Hukukul Allah, like, which is the rights of the people and rights of Allah. And in Sufism, I see more and more prevalent the humanism aspect of it. And that really, really helped me to, or rather opened my perspectives about it. And I went in with, I was seeking a re-entry or like reaffirmation into the religion. Minus today, like, we can't even use the word religion. It's like such a taboo. But I always had a very strong place for religion in my life. And my relationship with the power above was always very strong. And growing up, like, my father always said, like, you know, don't have a middle person in, you know, that have a direct contact with the power above. Okay. So you don't need, like, have these all these conduits. So I'm like, okay. So it was kind of not sure whether it is good, not good. I'm like, okay, but this was the time you experience it for yourself. So to me, coming into the Sufism was not like actively seeking something. It was just exploration of things. I just happened to walk in into the chapter and seeing a female spiritual guide, a leader like Sheikha Faria. It was an amazing, amazing experience. And
I mean, it sounds beautiful. And I truly agree with you when it comes to the concept of Sufism and how it manifests itself in serving humanity. And that's what Sufism emphasizes on. And that's the part of Sufism that I think as Muslims, we all are in awe of. Mm-hmm. So this is something that I ask all my guests, and I just love their answers. Describe America in one word.
Fulfilling.
Nice. I've gotten so many different answers, and as I said, it's like every time I ask an immigrant this question, they come up with such a beautiful expression of what they think America is. And if you could change one thing about America, what would that be?
Divisiveness.
You think it's more now than it was when you came in 90s?
Correct. Recently, at Thanksgiving break, I got to go visit my family in Atlanta. Like, my older brother lives there with his wife and two kids, and they're just an amazing, amazing... They have an amazing group of friends, and so it was always great to do Thanksgiving with them in its all entirety. The love for the bird is a little bit too much, but along with that, then we got to take a little trip to Gatlinburg in Tennessee. And let me tell you one thing. It made me so happy to realize the choices I have made living in here. I feel so privileged because there was such an opposition of thought process, or the experience over there was quite jarring. In a direct contact where people avoid eye contact with you or look the other way,
It's sad and it's derogatory.
It was. It was just. I mean, it's difficult to. I am still finding ways to describe it. Like, you know, to myself, what it was, but it wasn't something where I came here for. And if it is what it is, then this is not where I call home anymore.
So, if those people were listening right now, although I doubt they would be listening to my part, but if they were, if you could just remove one misconception about immigrants, what would that be? If you were to address those particular people?
Well, I haven't really come to my own sense of it, like what is it that I would tell them, but in general, the misconception about refugees or immigrants is always about they're here to take your job. Actually, they're not to take your job. They're not here to take the job away from the native born. They're here to explore opportunities, maybe financial and cultural or personal. Not each one of us is designed to come here to accumulate toys and build empires. Like, you know, some of us like come here because we want to learn something about ourselves. You know, what am I made of? What is it that I want to see? And what else is out there? So, you know, I don't know whether if the native understand that and not take this as a threat, I think it will create a beautiful environment of unity and hope for all of us to live together. And I know it sounds like a cliche, but I'm a project of hope. Like, you know, I'm all about how can we bring people together.
And Ali, in true sense of the word native, I don't even consider them natives. Because to me, it's, yes, they came, like their parents or the grandparents or whoever came a few generations before you and I. And that's the only difference that we have. Like, to me, that's the beauty of America, that everybody was an immigrant at some point or is an immigrant right now. So anyways, moving on, before I end our interview, which I am thoroughly enjoying, we will do rapid fire round. And this is like, it's going to be, yes, it will be fun questions.
I hope so. You're going to get it one way or another.
So my first question, fashion or film?
Both.
No, you have to choose one.
Fashion.
Oh, okay. On a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you and in what ways?
Out of chart.
Your biggest fear?
Nothing.
Really? If you could eat one food for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Good bread.
Yeah, me too. If you could only take 3 things to a deserted island, what would they be?
Voluntarily?
Yeah.
Is it by choice?
Yeah, by choice.
Okay, I'll take Wi-Fi with me. I'll take some water and a tool or something, like a knife or something like that. That's it.
Name 3 things on your bucket list.
That's easy. Africa.
Where in Africa?
All continent. Oh. I wanted to take 2 months just to travel all around, understand the different pockets of it and the cultural differences and tribal importance and work with indigenous culture and get to see some of that. I think that will be, I will be I'll die and go to heaven with that. So and the third one would be, I always wanted to open a vocational school for girls in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So that's always going to be my priority. I'm just not ready yet. I've been working towards it, and hopefully one day I'll be able to do that.
And if you could have any superpower, what would you want?
Time travel. Not because of the cliche, because my mind goes in a million places all the time. I'm here, I'm there. I'm like, I'm very visual.
I'm with you on that.
So I just thought it would be interesting to like go that, if I'm thinking about it, I'm building a whole story around it, it would be nice to be there present and literally make the difference of like, you know, is it something what I imagined or whatever it is, and welcome that.
Your biggest failure?
There are no failures in life. There's no failure for me. There are only experiences which could have gone wrong, but they're not. I don't look at things as failures or success.
Your biggest achievement?
An unconditional love from my family.
Mm. And if you were to describe yourself in three words?
STLC says crazy, sexy, cool.
What's the best
piece of... Can I redo that answer again?
Yes, you can.
Crazy, sexy, cool.
What's the best piece of advice you ever got?
I was working with Steve Jobs, and he said to me, never sell a product, always sell a brand. It was so early in my career, and I think it stayed with me in such a good place, and it helped me become a storyteller for the longest time, and I just think it's such a valuable advice, and more and more I looked at it from a different time in my career, and it has been such an incredible, in workspace, it was always such a parcel of knowledge that helped me achieve a lot in my life.
Your idea of vacation?
Experiencing different cultures off the beaten path.
Mm. Cultural diversity is?
Essential.
Favorite emoji?
Folded hands.
I like that one too. Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Really? I thought you would say tea. You're from Pakistan.
Coffee. Yeah, tea in like sometimes. The problem with tea is like I love tea also, but not everybody makes tea as it should be.
That's true.
And tea is like that. It's good, it's good. And there is not good, it's just not tea.
And can we say that chai tea is wrong? Because chai tea means tea. Can we just have either chai or tea?
Call it chai, then you know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Tea, we're going to be green tea, chamomile tea.
Just don't say chai tea.
I'm like, no, that is like a faux pas.
Shh. Home is?
Where my heart is. It's so important in my personal trajectory to be from everywhere and from nowhere. Mm. And this is what something I've been working on myself for a long time. It's like de-rooting yourself and make home where you are.
And on this positive note, we end our interview. Thank you so much, Ali, for coming to our show and for sharing your story.
Thank you, Sadia, for having me. It's been really, really fun. And I hope, we get to get some feedback from your listeners.
I would like to thank all the listeners for joining us today and those who have supported us. If you want to support us even more, subscribe to our podcast. And if you have a story to tell or any new ideas, please contact us at thealienchronicles@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @chroniclesalien. And you can find us on Instagram @thealienchronicles. Please stay tuned for our next episode when we will bring to you another immigrant story. And in the meantime, stay connected.